are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
It's my great pleasure to introduce Molly Ivins, the acclaimed humorist and syndicated columnist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, The Nation, The Progressive, Mother Jones, and she's now also a commentator on Morning Edition on NPR and for the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. And she's author of Molly Ivins Can't Say That, Can She?, which a number of you have gotten tonight. And I just want to talk very briefly about my first contact with Molly, which was 4 years ago when I called her because FAIR was going to begin its first marketing campaign. And I wanted to get an endorsement from Molly Ivins. And here's what she said about Extra. "You have to read Extra to find out all the stuff the establishment media won't tell you. They're all owned by hungry corporations, and Extra asks the questions that never even occurs to these deadbeats. Give money to these people. I believe none of us should ever contribute to any organization where the staff members make more than we do. Extra is a prime candidate for our generosity. The staff look like Ethiopian poster children. Big, sad eyes, little skinny legs, swollen bellies. Send money now." And she had never even seen Jeff Cohen yet. That's the best part. So here's Molly Ivins.
Thank you so kindly. This is such a wonderful sort of bivalve arrangement here. A lot of neck exercise this evening. I have a low voice, and it tends to drop when that happens, and y'all can't hear me in back. Just put up your hands and wave, and I'll amplify, turn up the volume for you. I was going to start by reinforcing your paranoid conspiracy theories about the mass media in this country. I know that you all believe that we are not allowed to tell the truth in the mass media, and indeed it is true. Our best work is never printed, and I thought I would prove that by giving you three new examples in one of our favorite categories of competition. Newspaper people are very competitive, and we compete in any number of esoteric categories, one of which is best lead ever written but not printed. One comes from your state. There's a place called Redwood City, California. I've never been there, but I understand that it is a semi-suburb of San Francisco. And there was a great struggle in the town about whether or not they wanted to just go ahead, give up, become another bedroom community, or whether they wanted to retain their sense of identity as in a small individual town. Well, naturally, the publisher of the local paper was go, go, grow, grow, bigger and better in Redwood City. And the impediment to growth at that point was that the sewage treatment plant had reached capacity. So my friend Will Lawson was ordered to go out and write a series that would convince the good voters of Redwood City to vote for bond issue to build a new sewage treatment plant. He went out, spent a week drinking heavily at the publisher's expense, came back, Wrote the following lead and then quit the newspaper. The lead was, even a sewage treatment plant can take just so much shit. In my home state, there is a perfectly dreadful place called Odessa, Texas. The newspaper, the Odessa American, is a perfectly dreadful newspaper. But they did run a front page story that deserves to be remembered by us all who have written weather stories over the years. There was a fender bender on, it's redundant to say a hot summer day in Odessa. A sporting goods van was rear-ended by another vehicle, and it caused the doors on the back of the van to pop open, and sporting equipment spilled all over the street. Even in Odessa, that would not normally be a front-page story, but they did have enough sense to print the following lead: golf balls the size of hail rained on the streets of Odessa. One of my favorites in this category was written by an unsung member of my profession. He was a reporter for the Associated Press in New Jersey. His lead went out over the A-wire but was never printed anywhere. It was the second day story on a sex ring scandal. The state troopers in Jersey had busted a sex ring and uncovered a clubhouse which was filled with whips and boots and spurs and various interesting paraphernalia. Big story in New Jersey. Second day, as always happens in your sex ring stories, they found a small black book containing the names of those who frequented this interesting establishment. And sure as a bad guy, the names of people who were extremely prominent in New Jersey society and political circles were in the black book. AP's second day lead was, the names of the whipped cream of New Jersey society. I spent 6 long years working for a newspaper called the New York City Times, and at the New York Times there was a name for what you could not get into the paper. We called them bigotisms. I was called after a wonderful reporter named Homer Bigot, who was famous for slipping things past editors, and you must understand that at the New York City Times there are ranks and ranks and ranks of editors, all of them dedicated to the proposition that it is their mission in life to take anything that is either interesting or amusing out of the story before it gets into print. Homer, back during the late 40s, was assigned to cover the presidential campaign of Tom Dewey in 1948. Now, Homer loathed Tom Dewey with a passion. And the editors knew full well that he loathed Tom Dewey. So they assigned him to cover his campaign with the expectation, of course, that it would be done in flawlessly objective and incredibly boring New York Times fashion. And when the campaign was over, the editors called him in and congratulated him. Homer, we're so proud of you. You have done the kind of job we at the New York Times expect of our reporters. Homer smiled. They said, Homer, what did we miss? He said, well, you might check the story of such and such a date. So they raced back to that issue of the paper and found a story. Homer had been covering Dewey making a whistle stop campaign in upstate New York. And the story was written in perfect New York Times style. The crowd was gathered at the railroad platform waiting for the train to come in. They had the Oompah band there. They had the children waving the flags. The train arrives. Dewey makes a speech from the caboose platform. It's all quoted in perfect accuracy. Everybody's name was spelled quite properly. And the last of the story describes the train pulling out and the band has commenced to oompah again and the kids are waving their flags, and the last line of the story is, and the train pulled away, comma, with a little jerk. You have You have to be subtle to get them past the editors of the New York Times. But it is always worth it. In my days in the Albany Bureau of the Times, we had an irresistible situation. There was a state senator named Roy Goodman, who is from the east side of Manhattan. He is a rare creature, almost like a unicorn. He is an actual liberal Republican. A nice, decent fellow, and also, this is what made it irresistible, heir to the Ex-Lax fortune. Right away, you see the temptation. But the desk was fully alive to the dangerous possibilities, and all session long, they took out one glorious line after another. And finally, it's the last night of the session. The guys up in Albany are log-rolling bills, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. Back in New York City, they're holding open the Times for our last report for the late edition. And we finally slipped it in, front page, last day of that session. State Senator Roy Goodman, R. Manhattan, heir to the Ex-Lax fortune and a usually regular Republican. Those of us who work for establishment media do rebel constantly in these sort of small ways. But I am here to talk to y'all tonight about a larger kind of problem, and that's what FAIR is about. When Ben Bagdikian wrote his book Media Monopoly, it was first printed in 1982, Ben made a survey and found that 50 corporations controlled most of the major media outlets in this country. We are talking about 1,787 daily newspapers, 11,000 magazines, 9,000 radio stations, 1,000 television stations, 2,500 book publishers, and 7 major movie studios, all controlled by 50 corporations. When the revised edition of Ben's book was printed in 1987, that number had fallen to 29. And as you know, the concentration of media ownership has gotten notably worse since then. At the end of World War II in this country, 80% of the newspapers in America were independently owned. Almost without any exception, every daily newspaper published in this country is now owned by one of 15 corporations. Those who think that that does not affect the variety, the diversity of what you read, you are sadly mistaken. The role of small independent papers like the one I used to edit in Texas called the Texas Observer, some Texans in the crowd. It is not that the First Amendment is breached by law, by force in this country. We don't have people coming barging in as they have had in communist countries in Eastern Europe to shut down independent presses, to destroy copies and issues of a newspaper that are offensive to the government. That's not what happens here. What happens here is that voices of dissent are marginalized and trivialized so that they become irrelevant, and no one ever hears them at all. I wanted to talk specifically tonight, because it's chiefly what I do, about the political press corps in this country. The political press in this country still covers elections in what is known as the horse race school. And I know that those of you who are politically sophisticated look down on that style of reporting, and indeed there are reasons to do so. But I can also tell you that it's not that easy to write about politics, even in that dated and inadequate way. Jack Germond likes to tell a story about the horse bettor who dreamed about the number 5 And you know how superstitious bettors are. This guy woke Bolt up right out of a sound sleep with the number 5, just vivid in his mind. He glanced over at the clock on the table next to him, and it was 5:55 in the morning. Well, now, if you're a horse player, goddamn, it's a message straight from the Lord God Almighty. And it was like that all day. He lived in New York City. His first appointment was at 555 Fifth Avenue. The cab fare was $5.55. I mean, it went on all day long. It was clear that God wanted him to bet 5. Well, he was no fool. He was out of the track that afternoon. He put everything he had, $5,000, on horse number 5 in the 5th race. The horse came in 5th. And that's what it's like to cover politics. There you are with everything you know and think you have learned about the whole game, and your goddamn horse keeps coming in 5th. It's a problem. I must say that this has been, it was in many ways an odd year for me. For the first time since 68, I was not on the campaign bus this year. I was unemployed. A salutary experience. I find that standing on the unemployment line, chatting to your fellow unemployment statistics, gives you a whole new perspective on politics in this country. I wouldn't recommend the experience to anyone, but I assure you that it is, in its own way, enriching. And because I was not on the bus, I felt particularly immune this year from the conventional wisdom. Which is a real problem, because if you are on the bus, if you are one of the reporters following the politicians as they campaign, there is a terrible tendency to wind up saying exactly what everyone else says. It's why I have never worked in Washington, D.C. What drives me nutty about that town is not that when I come into Washington, which is a city where everybody says what everybody else says, that I say to him, well, goddamn, I am fresh in from the prairies of Texas and you people are full of bullshit. No, the problem is I get to Washington, D.C., and after 10 damn minutes, I'm saying exactly what everybody else says. Drives me crazy, and that's why I stay in Texas. But this year, the conventional wisdom was refreshingly wrong from the beginning and has been wrong at every single turn. Great year to bet against the conventional wisdom. We are now, however, I think, beginning to see what the political press saw at the beginning of this campaign, before Gennifer Flowers and other tributes to the good sense of the media in this country. What we saw, or what my colleagues saw, and I didn't get it for a long time. Everybody kept telling me, Bill Clinton's the man, Bill Clinton's the man. And I had known Clinton as a neighboring governor, had considerable respect for his record, as a matter of fact, but he never struck me as somebody you would just fall madly in love with and get all excited about. I didn't pick up on it until I saw him come and campaign in South Texas, and I realized why my colleagues were excited. If you are a political reporter, it is great fun to see someone who practices political art really well. It's fun to see it done the way it should be. And the thing that Bill Clinton brings to campaigning that we have not seen for a long time is energy and joy. He loves this shit. Now, I'm about to try to make a case that I normally have enough sense never to try to make outside the boundaries of the great state of Texas. I will submit to you that while it is a terrible year to be running for office and to be a politician, because we are, as usual, pissed off at them, and as always, with great cause, in fact, being a politician is an honorable thing to do with your life. And it is my belief that we have not had in the presidency of the United States, a real master politician since Lyndon Johnson. Now, let me make my case before you boo and hiss. It is my belief that had it not been for the war in Vietnam, and I grant you that is a whole hell of a lot like saying, you know, if it had not been for the Hundred Years' War, that would have been a swell century. But if you will set aside Vietnam, I submit to you that Lyndon Johnson would have gone down as one of the greatest presidents in the history of this country. And I also submit to you that that son of a bitch could not have passed any character test ever devised by the human imagination. He was, however, a superb politician. He knew how to make the whole damn thing work. It is, in many ways, the government of this country like a giant Rube Goldberg contraption. And what Lyndon knew was which buttons to push and which levers to press. He knew where to kick it and when to hit it. He knew where to apply the oil and to get it to crank around and produce something that would help people. And we have not had anyone since who had any idea how to do that. Theoretically, George Bush, who was advertised as ready on day one, as certainly as much government experience as anyone we have elected in a long time, George Bush may or may not know how to get the Rube Goldberg contraption to work, but since he manifestly has not a single damn idea about what the hell he wants it to produce, the question seems to be moot in his case. Brace yourselves, here comes a really clanging cliche. Are you ready? All right. Normally in politics, you find that there are politicians fall loosely into two categories. There are people who are really good at running for public office and people who are really good at governing. Very rarely, those pursuits require entirely different and distinct sets of skills, and rarely do you find them married in one person. And the truth about Bill Clinton, as nearly as I've been able to observe it, this may be the best kept secret about the man, is that all this stuff about Elvis and Slick Willie and all of that misses the mark completely. The truth is that Bill Clinton is a serious policy wonk. He really is passionately interested in governance. His idea of a really great time, he went on a busman's holiday a few years back and spent his vacation at the South Shore Bank in Chicago, which some of you may know about. It's a community development bank that has had phenomenal success. He spent hours there talking to the people who worked there, finding out exactly how the bank worked. He then went out into the community and talked to people in the community about how it works. Clinton's idea of a really great night is sitting around talking programs and policy. And it will be, as far as the political end of this race goes, and obviously, by accident or design, I have no idea which, at least in large part by accident, Clinton has hit on something the Republicans have no idea how to handle, and that is his selection of Al Gore as his vice presidential candidate, which, as you know, flies in the face of conventional wisdom. Essentially, what Clinton did was twin himself. And it turns out that between Clinton and Gore, there is a synergistic effect. The whole is actually greater than the sum of its parts. You put the two of them together, I mean, that's an awful lot of Southern white boy on one ticket. But it actually works. And right now, of course, they're having a wonderful time. And the reason the press is giving them such a very light ride right now is because they are having a marvelous time. And it's been a long time since those of us in the political press corps have covered a campaign that was fun. Because negative campaigning has been so constant, it has not been a fun thing to do for a long time. occasionally, even in the middle of a negative campaign, you manage to have a good time. I myself enjoyed covering Clayton Williams' effort to become governor of the state of Texas. I wrote afterward in one of the magazines that lets me say what I want to, what may be the single pithiest piece of political analysis of my life, which is that what Clayton Williams has proved is that in Texas politics, it's okay to step on your dick, but you shouldn't just stand there and stomp on it. Now, my fellow Texan George Bush is in deep doo-doo right now. I have been covering George Bush as a political reporter since 1966. I believe that makes me the oldest living reporter on the George Bush is not actually a twit beat. He has twit tendencies, but not actually a twit. I'm really concerned about my man because, of course, he is at his worst when he is down, as he is now in the polls. I'll just give you an example. The best day I ever spent with George was late in the 1984 campaign. He was running for vice president of the United States against Geraldine Ferraro. And the honor of being the first man to run against the first woman, et cetera, was not clear to my fellow Texan George Bush. He was not a happy camper. And it was late in the campaign, and we were in southern Minnesota, and George had to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to milk a cow. In order to demonstrate his concern for the plight of the American farmer. Now, those of you who are politically sophisticated know that when an American politician milks a cow in order to demonstrate his concern for the plight of the American farmer, tradition requires him to wear a checked shirt. This underlines the depth of his concern for the plight of the American farmer. So George shows up at 6 o'clock in this barn. He's properly clad in his red and black checked shirt, but he has it on underneath his blue pinstripe State Department suit. It was the wrong look. He sits down. It was the worst case of attempted milking by a politician I have ever witnessed. Either George had forgotten how to milk or that cow was a Democrat. He could not get a drop out of her. He comes around the back of the cow to tell us in the press what's gone wrong, forgetting what no real Texan ever forgets. Yes, my friends, cows are retromingent. It's a word I only get to use when I tell this story. Cows are the only mammals that pee backwards, you see. All the rest of us warm-blooded furry creatures, we are forward peers, but not your cows. All up and down the leg of George's pinstripe State Department suit, it was not even 6:30 in the morning. And the whole day went like that. Every time they handed that poor man a baby, it would commence to scream as though someone had just stuck a pin into it. We got to Green Bay, Wisconsin. He told the crowd how much he loves the Minnesota Vikings. We finally get as far as Milwaukee, and George is holding a press conference. And this is because it was a couple of days after his debate, nationally televised debate with Geraldine Ferraro. Now, only your true political trivia buffs will recall this. But in the course of that debate, George Bush said that Walter Mondale had said that our Marines in Lebanon died in shame. Walter Mondale never said that. He said our Marines had died in vain. And he was pretty irate about having his words twisted on national television and had demanded that Bush apologize. And, of course, we in the press corps, delighted to keep an issue alive, had been fomenting this madly. With which he attempted to prove that in shame and in vain mean the same thing. Well, it was a performance so lame it was kind of embarrassing to be there taking notes on it. And word of it went to the Mondale entourage, which was here in California, as I recall, that day. And Mondale went into some kind of Norwegian rage and said rather stiffly, George Bush does not have the manhood to apologize. Well, this immortal quote was sent back to us in the Midwest. We go racing up to him. Mr. Vice President, Mr. Vice President, Mr. Mondale says you do not have the manhood to apologize. Well, do you have a response? And he looked at us all and said, well, on the manhood thing, I'll put mine up against his any time. So you can tell why I'm worried about my man. Gets unsettled, he's apt to say anything. I think the best prognosis for this race is fairly grim. My man George obviously cannot run on his record. He cannot run as the candidate of change, and consequently he has but one avenue open, and that is to attack the living shit out of Bill Clinton. Basically, this involves dropping more bimbos on Clinton. This time, however, it's not like picking on Michael Dukakis. There is a man named Jim Carville, who is known as the Raging Cajun. And Carville is clearly prepared to bimbo back. And the result will be that we are probably going to see the ugliest, tawdriest, sorriest political campaign any of us can remember. The upshot will be that people will become more cynical, more disgusted, and more turned off by the whole effort to have a democracy in this country. And I, for one, think it's a goddamn tragedy. While we in the press corps will be, of course, racing around trying to find out who slept with whom, a matter which, once we get it straight, will solve the national deficit immediately, just you watch. I would point out to you that, as usual, my brethren in the press corps are going to go to hell not so much for our sins of commission as sins of omission. It is what we do not write about that is the real problem. I frankly think we do a pretty good job of covering the horse race. But what we're not writing about is genuinely terrifying. I would just point out to you what I think are two major ones in terms of the economy, which should be the only story this year. We are due for an interest rate shock in late November that will be staggering. And we are also looking at a silent banking crisis that will actually make the SNL mess look small. If you follow carefully the small stories in the Wall Street Journal and on the business pages, you will find that the FDIC is now listing as banks in trouble, shaky banks, a number of large banks with total assets of $600 billion. We're talking bigger than the SNL crisis. And you have not, I trust, heard either candidate speak about this or seen many stories in the mainstream media about it. And I, once again, I am sorry to say this, but I think the press is failing in its responsibility. The extent to which the political press is tooled around by consultants and campaign managers who are skilled in having us cover non-events is really depressing. And all of us in the political press corps have these quadrennial post-election breast beatings where we all sit around after it's over and slap our foreheads and say, oh God, we screwed up again. Oh, Jesus, that was terrible. We'll never let them do the flag again. That was really terrible. And of course, every 4 years, we are once again missing the real story. And I'm afraid that this year is no exception. I will be happy to answer questions from you all about the campaign or anything else I might know something about. All right, I'm taking questions. Yes, sir, and back. It's a double question. One is whether or not I think Ross P. Rupp would make a good Secretary of Treasury. Actually, we are in such a deep hole, even that doesn't help. Do you know how long Ross P. Rupp's entire fortune would pay the interest on the national debt? You got it. 5 days. 5 days. And the other question was, would it be a good idea to have candidates run with cabinets, as they do in other parliamentary democracies? In other words, you run a whole slate of guys saying, okay, I'm running for president, this is who I want for vice president, and here's who all my cabinet guys are going to be. I tell you what I think is a more interesting way of doing it. I mean, we're just talking electoral reform here, is to vote. And I'm not even sure I can explain this. Somebody here may have to help me. It's the weighted vote. So if you say, here's my first choice for president, and my second choice for president, and my third choice for president, and none of the rest of these geeks am I even going to put on my wish list, that, of course, assumes that you got more than two candidates, which we almost had this year until my fellow Texan Ross Perot turned out to be all hawk and no spit. A real disappointment to many of us. Yes, ma'am.
Bush just to have another little war for himself before the election?
Do I expect Bush to have another little war to help his election chances? I actually am not that cynical, believe it or not. I hope I'm right about this. I don't think he'd do it just to get reelected. I really don't. I know that some people are that cynical, but I think the people who annoy me more are the, in fact, some of my colleagues in the press corps, most notably William Safire of the New York Times, actually wrote a column saying that Bush could either knock off Saddam, knock off Gaddafi, or knock off that dipshit in North Korea, and that if he didn't do it, he didn't deserve to be reelected. It is my hope, when I read things like that, that it would be the children of Bill Safire who would die in such an endeavor.
Yeah. I wonder what you think about what could be done to develop our own platform, like cable TV or something like that, where we have our own thing, we have to depend on them.
Yeah. It's a good question. I hope you all heard it over here. The question is, Fair's a great idea, but it drives him nutty that we have to beg and fight to get attention from mainstream media, to get into their forum. Why the hell don't we start our own, and how can we start our own? Well, of course, the typical answer is money. Nobody started a good progressive or left-wing paper in this country since PM. Last time I heard, and this was at least 10 years ago, it would take $6 million to start a major daily. I'm sure that's up around 15 by now. On the other hand, I don't think Ted Turner started with that much seed money. And we do have, particularly with cable and the new cable channels, some real opportunities for access. And I don't think anybody who is interested in helping change the media and offer alternative points of view should let any of those opportunities go by. I mean, it really is worth organizing for. I would point out to you again that in terms of the mainstream media, which spent the 1980s on the snooze, the people in my business missed the SNL scandal, we missed the HUD scandal, we missed Iran-Contra, but we covered the hell out of George Bush's problem with broccoli. I mean, that's what you're getting.
Yes, ma'am, in that.
The question was about, she reports that Vic Novosky of The Nation is noodling around with an idea for a cable channel and some progressive access, but of course needs money, as always. And also she had a query about William F. Buckley's source in a column today in the LA Times saying that Dan Quayle had offered his resignation to Bush. I have no idea who Buckley's sources are. Washington is agog with rumor at this point about the Veep. My theory is that it's a no-hoper for two reasons. One is that George Bush is notoriously loyal to the people who work for him. In fact, John Sununu would still be working for him if he had not gone out and again misused public transportation, taxpayer-paid transportation, after the first flap over it. The second thing is that Quayle, as much fun as he is to laugh about, doesn't make much difference in the election. Of course, in a very close election, everything makes a difference. But traditionally, that's not true of whoever is running for Veep. I mean, sure, Al Gore will probably make mincemeat out of him in a debate. But Lloyd Benson made mincemeat out of him in a debate. It didn't make a damn bit of difference. Yeah.
I heard through a Life magazine reporter that the Republican Party is not going to run George Bush because he's too sick.
I know. That's another very popular rumor right now. The press in Washington just loves to go into these rumor tizzies. It is true, and I point out this is also true in the matter of Dan Quayle, just as a matter of responsibility. We have a 68-year-old president who has Graves' disease and who was certainly, the reason this is a current rumor about Bush's health is because during the European trip, the one he just came back from, the big economic summit. Apparently the Graves' disease is a little worse. There's one corner of his mouth that is dragging, and he was foul-tempered, and as a British friend of mine said, correspondent friend of mine said, he was ratty, ratty the whole time. And that's where the health rumors got started. But I just, you know, I just don't see it. Yeah.
Molly, do you think you can trust Bill Clinton on civil rights when the letter he wrote to Southern Californians immediately after the local riot or uprising, depending on your choice of words, did not mention the Rodney King verdict, denounced looting and violence, and said nothing but nothing whatsoever about the causes or the context?
The question is, can you really trust Clinton on civil rights? And she cites specifically the letter he wrote to Southern California right after the riots here, failing to mention anything, the Rodney King verdict and other the social and economic injustice. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but I tend to trust Southern liberals just because it was real hard to be a liberal in our part of the country for a long time. I mean, you really had to pay your damn dues. And all of us who were in the civil rights movement in the South, it was not, I mean, there was not only was there no such thing as political correctitude, but there was no support. I mean, it was just, you lost your friends, you lost your family. It was not easy. And so I figure anybody whose record goes that far back can be trusted. But I point out to you that there is no question at all, and this is the reason, at least in my case, I think you may admire Clinton as a politician, and you may admire him in office, but you don't give your heart to the guy, is he's playing politics with it. And to my mind, the classic case was when he confronted Jesse at the Rainbow Coalition over Sister Soldier and just dissed him to his face in front of the Rainbow Coalition. That was a damn setup for political points. Yeah. She had caught me on television during the Democratic Convention and was under the impression that I was somewhat subdued. Exhausted and hungover is all. Actually, I flunked Media Cynicism 101 again. I loved the convention. Thousands of people doing ridiculous things while wearing silly hats. I thought it was bliss. All right. Yes, way in back.
What are the chances that Clinton can win?
What are the chances Clinton can win, in my opinion? Like most people in my business, I bet on politics, and I make money betting on politics. And one reason I do is that I never put any money on a political race any closer than 6 weeks out. And I think anybody who does is a borderline moron. There are too many imponderables. There are too many things that might happen for anybody to call this race at this point. I think we will have a much better sense of it. And these polls, these July polls, mean absolutely nothing. We'll have a better sense of it after we see the numbers after the Republican convention. At that point, we should have a better sense of it.
Molly?
Yes.
Do you think Clinton and Gore should have moved so quickly to endorse the noises that Bush is making about bombing Baghdad again? Is that what it must be?
Do I think that Clinton and Gore should have moved so quickly to endorse the noises Bush has been making about bombing Baghdad again? That's another one of those things that you can admire Clinton, but you're not ever going to give him your heart the way you have some of our great losers of the past. George McGovern comes to mind, such a thoroughly decent man. No, I don't. And in fact, it seems to me now that Saddam, as George always calls him, looks like he's going to back down and there's not going to be a confrontation. I think they look particularly as though they had done that for political reasons. Gore, as you may have some credence. Well, actually, they both supported the Gulf War. The lady in yellow. What the economic and social implications for the country would have been if H. Ross Perot had actually been elected president. I must tell you that I shouldn't have done this, but I did. I had days when I thought about voting for him just for the sheer interest of seeing what the hell would happen. In fact, I suppose I should have, as you all know, I have had a wonderful time in the last 5 months making fun of Ross Perot, but I think about it now in retrospect, and I should have from the beginning been far more sarcastic and mordant. Because in many ways, the reason I took Perot seriously is not only because $100 million is about as serious as you can get in politics, but also because I am accustomed to seeing him in public action in Texas. I mean, it did not strike me as such a freakish notion that this right-wing populist billionaire, which, as I have pointed out, is the best oxymoron produced by the political system since Reagan memoirs. The reason that didn't strike me as so freaky is because I had seen him in action in Texas in a political context. And because of that, I sort of failed to grasp exactly how absurd the entire idea was. The first time I ever wrote about him, it was right after the governor had named him to head up this commission on the reform of Texas schools. And it was right around the time Ronald Reagan, in a rare moment of alertness, had noticed that there was something wrong with the public schools and said that he was going to appoint a blue ribbon committee. And so I closed my column meditating on all this by saying, and so you see at the national level we have a man with a mind a half an inch deep. And at the state level a man with a mind a half an inch wide, both prepared to save the public schools, God help the children. The next day, the phone rang, and this boy said, "Miss Ivins, this is Ross Perot." Because he really does sound like a chihuahua. "You send your column, I have mine half an inch wide." And I thought, God damn, here comes a zillion-dollar libel suit. And I said, "Well, Mr. Perot, I guess I did kind of say that." And he said, "Well, all my friends say you're wrong. They say it's only a quarter of an inch." And then one day, I announced to my astonished readers that Ross Perot is a communist. worse, an agent of the Kremlin. There could be no other possible explanation for the man having attacked the foundation of the entire Texian way of life. He had come out against football. So I knew he was a Red. And he called the day after that column, the day that column appeared, and said, "Well, I've been called a lot of things before. It's the first time I've ever been called a communist. I think I'll have Jerry Falwell pray for me." And then one time I was writing a column and I needed an example of a big rich guy. I was writing about the insanity of that 1986 tax reform, so-called, where we abolished the progressive income tax and instituted a two-tier flat tax rate. And I'm explaining to my readers why this is truly a dreadful idea. And I close by saying, and so you see, if you make more than $17,500 a year, you are now in exactly the same tax bracket as H. Ross Perot. And then, to create a balanced sentence, I put comma. Who makes more than $1 million a year? You see, I wanted to give some idea of the disparity between your measly 17.5 and this guy who's serious rich. And I didn't check. It was the fatal journalistic error. I knew he was big rich. I figured more than $1 million a year, I was safe. So I printed it. The next day, the guys at our business desk in Dallas call. They're laughing their asses off. They say, "Ivins, H. Ross Perot makes $1 million a day." Shit, I didn't know Kuwait made $1 million a day. I'm sitting there thinking, boy, this is really going to be an embarrassing correction, when the phone rings and the operator says, "H. Ross Perot calling collect for Molly Ivins. Will you accept the charges?" Whether or not Ross is going to get in, and his interpretation is that Perot got into the race to destroy any chance the Democrats might have for getting a mandate. I don't see it that way. I think Perot is genuinely impulsive. I think he got in on an impulse. I think he got out on an impulse. Basically, Ross Perot knows no more about running for public office than a hog does about Sunday. Now, if he were genuinely bright, he would, given that circumstance, have listened to the people who do know how to run for public office. He was not even smart enough to do that. And that's pretty much the end of that story. He does not listen to other people. And boy, did it show. All right, we're going to do two more. All right, yes, ma'am, in back.
This is Jamie Sutter, but just as a resident of Los Angeles, I've been concerned about the articles I read in the Los Angeles Times about silicone and women and sickness.
I can only speak in general terms about the way, the question is, she's very concerned about the silicone story, the health problem involved in that, and it's raised questions in her mind about whether the press covers issues like this, whether men are interested in women's health stories and so on. I have seen a couple of really clear cases of where I know that the fact that the press is run by men affects the way news about women's health is played. And I the one that just still sticks in my mind is toxic shock syndrome. If some commonly used drugstore item had been killing men, I assure you it would have hit the front pages long before toxic shock syndrome did for women. It is, however, I think true both not just of the press but also of the medical establishment that they tend to overlook and neglect women's health issues. I would add a kind of, on the other hand, he had a wart note, which is that, as you know, the press is constantly filled with stories saying, you know, you're going to die if you eat bacon, and then it turns out that wheat germ is bad for you, and no matter what the hell the study is, there seems to be one to reverse it. I really don't think we need yet in a great tizzy about this. It's kind of, check with a woman doctor, hon. Okay? Thank you. Thank you.
Listener-supported community radio, KVU FM in Portland.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO's fall membership drive will kick off September 15th, and our theme is The Sounds of Democracy. KBOO is non-commercial, independent, and community-supported radio, one of the most democratic forms of media. During the drive, we'll feature content focused on democracy throughout the radio day. On September 15th, the Old Mole Variety Hour will look at democracy through the lens of cultural work, how the arts like music, photography, theater, and fiction raise up the voices of those too often silenced by the corporate media. As a premium for KBOO donors, the Moles are offering prints of Betty Lee's photography, which document two decades of activists in the streets of